Hi, everybody, and welcome to Tapped in Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me today is my guest, Julian Vane. Julian is a British independent scholar and author with over four decades of experience in esoteric culture, including druidry, chaos magic, indigenous shamanism, Freemasonry, and witchcraft. How are you doing, Julian?
I'm doing very well, Adam. Thank you very much for inviting me on the podcast. It's most appreciated.
No, I've read some of your books, Getting Higher, The Manual of Psychedelic Ceremony, which is really interesting. I recommend to people who are trying to get into psychedelics and figuring out how it works for them, which is, I think, a very valuable text for people to read.
Yeah, I mean, what I wanted to do with that book was just to create something that was incredibly accessible. It was, to some extent, sort of almost written with my children, perhaps my eldest son, in mind. And in fact, there's an example that's used fairly early on in the book that talks about, you know, why does it matter to have psychedelics within particular contexts? And the example is one I remember giving to him when we were speaking. I said, you know, you can take something like LSD and you can be in a situation where you look up and you say, oh my goodness, look at all the little faces in the trees. And that might be a source of delight if you're with good people in a good place. Or the same experience, my God, look at all the little faces in the trees. Yeah? Same perception, but within a context that's less supportive and less pleasant. And so yeah, I mean, the point about the book was to kind of, was also to talk about the idea of ceremony, which interestingly is a word that gets used even within quite conventional psychedelic therapeutic settings. They'll often still talk about the session as a ceremony.
Yeah, and I kind of equate that to ritualism, oddly enough. You know what I mean? I guess those two things are somewhat synonymous with one another. But it is interesting how we all seek, and even going into materialistic sort of clinical setting, this whole idea of ritualism and ceremony has sort of been moved over to that, which I think is pretty relevant, because the moment you try and take a psychedelic experience into a sterile environment, I think you lose a lot of the context, specifically what you're referring to and before about the interpretations of what you're experiencing, which is pretty relevant.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm all in favor of there being multiple environments in which people could experience psychedelics, recreational environments, festival environments, therapeutic environments with high levels of support for people who are wrestling with very difficult processes within their lives, peer support networks, large scale raves. You know, I think that there are many benefits in lots of different ways. You know, you and your friends going off for a walk in the woods one day with some mushrooms. You know, the different range of these spaces, I think, is really important.
Yeah, no, entirely reasonable. And so, you know, I want to get back to this, but we have a lot of ground to cover and you have a lot of really cool stuff to talk about. So let's just kind of get into the idea of, you know, you've spent four decades sort of in this environment, independent author, you've wrote many books. You know, how did you sort of get to this place? Like, what led you down this path? Because four decades is a long time to commit yourself to something.
Okay, so I'm 55 now. And I got interested in the esoteric I've been interested in it for as long as I can remember. So whether or not that's a reincarnatory experience or a type of neurological disorder, I don't know. But I was just really, really into all that kind of stuff when I was a kid. Became involved in, you know, haphazardly from books and any resources I could find prior to the existence of the internet, teaching myself as far as I was able, things like meditation, yoga. Didn't come from a family background associated with any of this kind of stuff. Got into the whole kind of neo-pagan thing because that was the easiest point of kind of access in Britain in the 1980s. So became involved in kind of Wicca, so modern neo-pagan witchcraft. And from that, had always really been interested in the ideas of ritual and ceremony and the idea of magic and what that might be and what that might mean. And over that period of time, had the opportunity to work in ceremony with lots of different types of people, lots of different styles, you know, like it says on the bio, you know, druids and Freemasons and blah, blah. And I guess part of the kind of the lineage of the Western magical tradition is the use of psychoactive substances, some of which are, we could say, relatively gentle. So frankincense, for example, as used in incense, is a mood lifter, an elevator, you know, it has a pharmacological action. And then there are stronger things as well. And they're kind of part of that tradition. So I kind of got interested in this stuff. and explored that both, you know, reading in a kind of scholarly way, but also very practically in terms of experimentation myself and with friends, with the groups I was associating with. And then this thing called the psychedelic renaissance came along, and it was like, dude, turns out all the weird stuff you're interested in is now like a thing. And so that's basically like the short version of the tale.
Well, and it's vaguely funny, right? Because I've been, you know, in this, not four decades, but like, you know, I grew up, got into raving, and oddly enough, you know, the circumstance you were describing before about doing psychedelics in that context versus a different context is a very, very different thing. You know, at a rave, you have this collective sort of environment, you know, fueled by MDMA or ecstasy. And then you incorporate a little bit of psychedelics in there. And it's a very profound and binding collective experience versus what I perceive to be a individual ceremony to be, you are alone with yourself. But being alone also in that sense is very connected to the greater human consciousness, perhaps. So one of the things I really want to talk to you about is, you know, before I've done episodes where we discussed, you know, the Eleusinian mysteries, the notions of Christianity being sort of this originating from a neo-Christian psychedelic sort of organization. And then you look at, you know, the Romans with the Mithras and their extent of Zoroastrianism and the psychedelic seemingly involved in all these cultures. And then there, to me anyways, in my knowledge, there seems to be sort of this gray blank space, you know what I mean, moving forward. And you sort of specialize in psychedelic use, obviously coming from Druidism and all that different things. So how did European and thereby for extension Western culture in North America, how did our psychedelic use move forward from what one might perceive as the ancient times?
Well, Adam, that's such a delicious question. I know, there are right? So many ways of like looking at that. Okay, so just to begin with, you've spoken and mentioned the Eleusinian mysteries. You know, once the Eleusinian mysteries, once the temple closes in just before 400 AD, something of that order, then the psychedelic experience within Northwestern European culture, Mediterranean culture, kind of vanishes in some respects. And one might argue that the absence of that within culture is the thing that drove those nations to predatory activity across the rest of the globe. Rather like an addict looking for uppers and downers, you know, cocaine and sugar and coffee and opium and so forth. Anyway, but there is some difficulties. For example, in the British Isles where I am, the first record that we have of an intoxication with what was pretty much identifiably magic mushroom psilocybin is like in the late 1700s, where we have an accidental poisoning that happens by a family who are collecting mushrooms in a sort of parkland in London, and they brew them up, and then the doctor is called because they are suffering bouts of immoderate laughter and have wildly dilated pupils. And there's a drawing of the specimen. And, you know, if you go and read Andy Letcher's book, Shroom, you can read the detail of the story. And that's the first time we have a textual reference. History is about writing. So it's the first time we have a written reference about these mushrooms in the British Isles. We can conjecture that perhaps in, you know, ancient times, the Druids or perhaps other kind of communities within, say, Britain and other places were making use of these things. Maybe Eleusis was the monopoly, and maybe that was part of the problem. We know that further east, there's probably some very, very interesting kind of examples of psychedelic use that we could point to in old Europe, in Eastern Europe, and certainly in kind of when we look at Scandinavia. We see little kind of pieces, you know, the story about Amanita and so on. But you're right. It is like this kind of, suddenly there's this dark ages, and then we have the kind of rediscovery of psychedelics in Western culture as they start coming over. Mescaline arrives in London in the late 1800s. And we have this kind of re-engagement. We also have the story then of people, particularly in North America and elsewhere, looking at those entheogenically lineaged cultures. So the people like the Wararica people, often known as the Huicholi people, who are making use of things like peyote and so on. You've got the ayahuasca using communities in South America and so forth. But there is a story. There are traceable lineage within the kind of the Western European story as well. Where a lot of that goes is it goes into alchemy. It goes into the kind of pharmacology that was being used within things like ceremonial magic. So if you can go to this cluster of books called the Grimoires, which kind of, you know, they start getting printed fairly early on. As soon as printing becomes a popular thing, books of spells become really popular, you know. And if we look at these, both the ones that have come from kind of Islamic lineaged types of ceremonial magic and others that come from kind of Jewish lineage types of ceremonial magic, what we see is we kind of find all kinds of rituals and talisman making and all kinds of interesting stuff going on. But possibly one of the most interesting things that's relevant to our conversation is when you look at what kind of incenses are being used, what kind of ointments are being used, what sort of stuff is being used. You can do a ceremonial magic ritual to evoke a demon into a scrying mirror, and that might well work successfully. But if you put some henbane and some cannabis in the incense that you're using, it is much more likely to be a successful magical operation. So, yeah, we can trace all kinds of little, and they are very much kind of breadcrumbs as far as the Western European story is concerned, but they are definitely there. So there is a kind of a lineage of practice of exploring the altered states of awareness that can come from psychoactive substances, particularly henbane, particularly cannabis, to some extent, possibly things like acacia. So perhaps there's even a kind of a little kind of connection with DMT tryptamines in there. Yeah, there's definitely connections, stories to be told.
Well, and I think the difference between, you know, the cultures that you describe, like the Mazatec and the cultures that have been embracing psychedelic use for a variety of different reasons and so deeply entangled with their culture, it's palpable, it's obvious the cultures have embraced them. Whereas I feel in Europe, Catholicism or Christianity itself worked to sort of eliminate psychedelic use, perhaps, throughout Europe. And obviously, I don't know that to be true, and hence why we're having this conversation. But, you know, the witch hunts, in my understanding, outside of just being profoundly misogynistic and horrific, were also about stamping out paganism and witchcraft, which had a tendency to use psychedelics as a mechanism to commune with the other side or their spirituality.
I mean, there's lots of ways we can talk about this. I mean, one way we could talk about this is historically when the Roman Empire gets separated into the Greek-speaking bit over in the east and the Latin-speaking bit over in the west. One thing that happens is in the absence of lots of Greek medical texts, Western Europe doesn't have very much medicine. Doesn't have very much at all. It's quite impoverished. We have the, for example, the medical work of the classical medic Galen, his work on humours. You know, people very often have heard these kind of ideas. So you definitely have a kind of a deficit in terms of medical knowledge that's available until we hit the Renaissance and we start getting all of those classical texts coming back in. I mean, that's what the Renaissance is. It's the reemergence of classical, particularly Greek classical tradition, from which eventually comes things like natural philosophy and what we would now understand as science. It comes from that kind of lineage. In Western Europe, the position of religion is such that it's the dominant way of understanding the world. Disease is often understood in terms of, you know, God's punishment or the necessity of suffering and so on. And so there is a very impoverished medical tradition there. There are, of course, practitioners. There are medics. There are various descriptions, including at a kind of grassroots level. So the kind of the midwives and the healers and so on. In fact, actually, historically, it's not quite true to say that the Catholic Church does this thing to destroy the witches and blah, blah. I mean, there's a thing called the Murrayite hypothesis or the witch cult hypothesis, which is this idea that there was this other sort of hidden underground pagan religion, which the church was destroying. And the short answer is that doesn't seem to be the case. It's also the case, actually, that most prosecutions for witchcraft actually come from within the Protestant tradition for all kinds of historical reasons we can get into. The Catholics are not, they're fascinated by heresy. They want to root out and burn heretics. That's a thing. But Catholicism, in a funny kind of a way, is much more magical than a lot of the Protestant tradition, because in Catholicism, you can have a mass said for a particular purpose. You have a bunch of saints. You have propitiatory laying of talismans at the shrines of these places. It's much more, it's monotheism, but it's kind of
there's
monotheism.
There's more pageantry, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It is, yeah, very much so, because you have a variety of different saints which all operate in unison, which is reminiscent of like Greek, Roman, and even Indian, like Hindu culture.
So you start to get this thing with people like Luther and people like kind of the Protestant forms of Christianity, you get this, again, it's a very kind of flattened architecture in the imaginary universe. It's basically you, the Bible, and God. And like anything that sits outside of that is obviously the work of the devil. So a lot of the kind of persecutions for witchcraft, they are examples of various kind of othering and scapegoating behaviors. There are a small number of people who we might describe as magical practitioners, or academics these days call either cunning folk or service magicians, who get prosecuted, but they're actually in the minority. It's mostly about kind of social disturbance and then looking for a scapegoat, and looking for a scapegoat where whatever's going wrong must be the work of the devil. There aren't any kind of natural causes in the world. You know, like you and I, when an accident happens, we just go, stuff happens, doesn't it? But actually, in those kinds of ways of thinking about the universe, everything has a particular reason. It's either from God or from the devil.
Yeah, it's like establishing direct causation to every event, where the devil did this because of something that someone in our community has perpetuated. But that's also interesting when you say that Catholicism was slightly more understanding of these traditions, where it was sort of, you know, Martin Luther nails the proclamation, and you have the Protestant faith moving, and then the pilgrims moving to North America, and then continuing to perpetuate the witch trials in Salem and stuff like that. And that's actually an interesting concept I never really thought about, that the different sects within Christianity themselves have higher or lower tolerances to what someone might perceive as pagan acts that require punishment.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. And I think that you know, one of the things we have to understand is that, you know, if you go and look at the corpus of sort of magical literature, you know, from say the late medieval period, sort of, you know, 13, 1400s through to, from the point where we start getting kind of books mass produced, certainly, we can see that this is magic, but it's very much within the kind of confines of a kind of a Christian view of the universe. This is not like a paganism. Like modern neo-paganism is a very new process, a very new idea. There are similarities between it and ancient paganism, but there's not a kind of direct lineage. If you'd have gone to speak to a person who was providing you with a divination service, you know, reading your cards or casting your astrological chart in, say, Elizabethan England, they would have definitely been a Christian, absolutely, because everybody's a Christian. But Christianity, as they say, is a broad church, and there are certain forms of Christianity and periods within the Christian tradition where this is completely fine. And it's always frowned on, but often the people, certainly in the witchcraft trials, who get prosecuted, they're often random people. I mean, the town that I live in, Biddeford in North Devon, saw the last prosecution for witchcraft in England in 1682. The three women who were executed were basically three women on the margins of society who happened to be the scapegoats for that community. Were they healers or witches or guardians of psychedelic knowledge? No, they weren't. Unfortunately, you know, they were just random people who were felt the ire of not even the mob, but they were kind of an excuse to kind of take the sting out of all sorts of other social problems that were going on.
Well, and that's an interesting concept where, you know, you have this increase of social pressures and you just find someone to basically fill the category of the monster, and then simple causation, you kill those people, everyone feels better temporarily until some new thing emerges. And so, you know, you talk about the ideas of different sects of Christianity, but then you have Christian Gnosticism, which in itself is, I don't know, say esoteric, but a unique form of Christianity that has a tendency to be a little bit more associated with psychedelics, in my understanding.
I mean, talking about the lineages that we can trace. So I've just been preparing an essay for a collection that's coming out hopefully this year. And one of the things I was looking at was examples of psychoactive, and particularly looking for psychedelic, but let's call generally psychoactive substances being used in the medieval grimoires, in these spell books and so on. And one of the things that's really interesting about that is that there are two forms of kind of knowledge about working with these substances that today are just very interesting. I mean, one is the use of like entourage effects. So we know that the way that we tend to work with drugs now is that we find a plant or a fungus or whatever it happens to be, and we try and extract the active ingredients. And that's a very valuable approach. It's very useful. But one of the approaches that seems to have been more important within the kind of, let's call it the esoteric tradition, is the blending together of things. So the blending together of combinations of oils, and the fact that various things, when you mix them together, they have particular effects. Ayahuasca is the most obvious example. Independently, you know, the Banisteriopsis is, you know, if you just take it on its own, you will notice it. The Chacruna, not so much. You put them together, it's a very different beast. So I can, you know, there are examples you can go to. You can say, oh, this is really interesting. So here's a text from, I don't know, the 16th century, where there's a particular blend being used. And you can start to look at some of the chemistry of those things and say, this is fascinating, because this suggests an understanding of chemistry, which obviously isn't the kind of molecular chemistry we have now, but there's some wisdom in there about how these blends are being made. There are a couple of examples of things that are used, for instance, with cannabis, which is one of the primary ingredients, primary mind-altering substances, which accelerate the effect of cannabis. So there are entourage effects being used, and it's in the literature, you know, so we're talking stuff from 500 years ago. So that's really interesting. I mean, incidentally, cannabis is a psychedelic, and anyone who says it's not simply hasn't eaten enough of it.
I was going to say the subtle difference between, you know, combusting and then consuming, like, you know, and I've heard the idea of, like, you know, assassin just stems from the word assassin, which basically this group of Islamic individuals in the Moroccan area where they would consume massive amounts of hash to put themselves in a trance-like state, which was the basis of their religion and their sacrament. And yeah, man, you eat a bunch of edibles, I mean, you will have a psychedelic experience.
Aleister Crowley, when he writes about his first experience of samadhi, this kind of rarefied state of meditative consciousness, does so as a result of taking a big load of hash, and then spends a lot of time in this essay going, was it the drugs? Was it the... And he kind of resolves it by saying, well, it just was the thing. The other thing about this lineage is that there are pieces in there that suggest quite a deep knowledge of the pharmacopoeia as well. So there's a reference I've just found from a female writer, and unusually a female voice, writing about different magical herbs that you can use in about, I think she's writing about 1890, and she mentions blue lotus or blue lily. So the Nile lotus, which we know, you know, that's psychoactive. We only know that that's psychoactive. We've only known that for what, like 30 years. It's been a relatively recent discovery that, hey, turns out this thing that's in all the ancient Egyptian iconography is actually a pharmacologically active agent. And yet it's referred to in this book from the Victorian period. So there's a fractured and broken and confused and interesting though this thing is, there are definitely these kind of connections. And I think one of the things for me is that this is also about we as modern people encountering these substances. You know, we look, and very wisely, to those cultures that have got entheogenic lineages, and we say, you know, guys, you know, we're trying to figure out how, you know, we operate with this weird stuff. You've been doing it for a while. Any tips, you know, basically. And that's great. But there are also these other things that can be found kind of within the material from Europe. And those also then in turn have kind of links to things like Africa, because, you know, if you take alchemy, for example, alchemy literally means the science of the black land, and the black land is Egypt. And a lot of the kind of the mythical kind of basis for Western magic is North Africa. And again, Africa is another one of those regions where when we have this conversation about, oh, psychedelics, this is how we do the ritual, blah, blah, There's a great guy, Darren Springer, Darren LeBaron, he's often on the internet as, and he does this brilliant talk where he shows a map of like, here are all the places where mushroom cults have been found. And it's like mostly South America and North America and like, a few places in India and blah. And he says, this is not a map of where people use mushrooms. This is a map of where American anthropologists want to take their holiday. So it's like, he's right. You know, like Africa is this big, like there's nothing there. And that's completely untrue. It's completely untrue. So we've got a whole bunch of research yet to unfold to make this a fuller story.
Well, and that's interesting too, because like Africa, psilocybin mushrooms grow almost everywhere in sub-Saharan Africa. And there's multiple evidence to suggest that all sorts of tribal groups have used a variety of different DMT-containing plants for a variety of different reasons, from hunting lions to killing each other, you know, tribal warfare, you know, inter-degree ceremonial usage. So it's, you know, I've always thought that, you know, people talk about, oh, we're entering this age, this experiment of using psychedelics. And I would say the experiment was us not using psychedelics in Western culture.
That's a very good point. In fact, in the essay that I'm writing, one of the things I say is that, you know, there was a period in late 20th century occultism when psychedelics and psychoactives were not seen as part of the tradition. There was a big sort of push away from that for two reasons. One, to do with social acceptability and people saying, you know, this is like, we're not sacrificing goats here. This is cool, you know.
Yeah.
Which was a thing. And the other thing, of course, is just because it's in the shadow of the war on drugs and occulture, like anything else, is responsive to its context. But actually, that's an anomaly. Actually, that's the weird thing. Yeah, I completely agree. That's absolutely right. And I think that as we enter this period and we sort of look around, not only can we look towards those cultures that have got kind of an older and deeper lineage with these substances, but I think that also, and this is really important for me, and this is just to some extent what Writing Getting High was about, is that we also want to recognize our own inherent human understanding of these things. You know, like you meet someone for the first time, you're a Euro-American person, and what do you shake them by the hand. That's really interesting, isn't it? So you use what is actually like, that's a Mithraic sign. It's a Mithraic, it's the way that the brothers of Mithras would introduce each other. They would meet each other by shaking hands. We now use that as a kind of a general way of greeting. But the point about that is whether or not you do that, or you do namaste, or you put your hand on your heart, or you do whatever it is you're doing, those rituals are so simple and commonplace that we don't even recognize that that's a ceremonial ritualizing behavior. That's the use of a kind of symbolic behavior. And we do this all the time. And you mentioned earlier this thing about raves. I always think raves are fascinating. So here you have this substance, MDMA, which is like a daughter of the mescaline molecule, essentially,
right.
the chief alkaloid from peyote. And it drops down into culture. And the culture responds by setting up an environment that allows for free-form dancing with a repetitive beat, and another environment that allows for conversation and reflection. And we call this the rave. You know, this is the dance floor and the chill-out room. And the beat that we have is this boom, 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 boom. If you step inside the teepee for their peyote circle,
right? Yeah,
it's exactly the same. And the beautiful fire, what's called the arrow fire, that's produced in the center of the circle, and the way it's the firekeeper will rake this out into various patterns. That's amazing visual technology when you don't have access to lasers. You know, it's like it's really, really similar. And the thing about the rave is it's an emergent process. You know, nobody sat down and designed it. You know, what's the optimum environment for a group of people to take MDMA? I mean, you know, it's a much more intuitive process that kind of flows out. So we can look at those people who can give us hints and tips about from their tradition and their experience, and that's brilliant. And we should, you know, honor and appreciate those things and not try and misrepresent ourselves as part of a thing that we're not. But we should also recognize that whoever we are, we actually have built in a whole bunch of ritualizing behaviors which just come with being a human. And if you can listen to what the medicine wants, often you can find the environment to create the environment that the medicine will respond to well.
Well, and You know, just to jump back for a second on that, is that when you talk about these innate human instinctive things towards creating bonds with one another, I think that really is just a byproduct of the our profound need to be in contact with one another, which gives us the strength that we have of humans. You know, we're a profoundly social species, and it's not no wonder that solitary confinement is considered torture. And yet we all have these natural instinctive mechanisms that move us towards solidifying relationships with one another. And you're absolutely right. Like, you know, the whole rave scene was profoundly organic. And it obviously started mostly in London, moved to like sort of Detroit. And then, you know, Toronto, where I was in the rave scene, was like a pretty solid rave scene in the late 90s and stuff. And it was a very organic moment preceded by this sense of just belonging and empathy that just permeated the whole environment. And you see that predominantly, like, you know, like you said, you know, the rhythmic beating of drums, trance-like states, and, you know, being that MDMA and methamphetamines are a derivative of the same chemical compound and class that mescaline is, it's hard not to wonder the similarities between those two things. It's actually really interesting.
I mean, there are even similarities in as much as in the peyote circle, at least the ones I've attended, there's usually a thing called a water drum. So the water drum is, from my perspective, I've recognized it as a cauldron. It's a little pot, usually with three legs. And a buckskin's placed over it, water's placed in it, buckskin's placed over it, and then some beads are put into the buckskin, and it's bound in such a way that the skin is held down tight on the drum. And then the drum is periodically made wet just by turning it up and down while it's being used in the teepee. And the reason that this thing exists is because the Native American people were not permitted to have drums. So they improvised in this way. And the reason it's a water drum is in part to deaden the sound so that you don't hear it very easily outside the teepee. Now, the thing about that that's really fascinating is that in British law, in I think it was 1990, they passed into law a description of rave music as music consisting wholly or predominantly of a succession of repetitive beats. And that was enshrined in law. So the music became something that was criminalized in the same way that the drum had been criminalized by these people in the Native American culture. The other thing that's interesting, of course, is that, you know, the people, for example, of the people who live in the plains in North America, peyote was not a medicine that they used very frequently. It moved north throughout the, particularly the latter part of the 19th century into the 20th century. So the Native American church style peyote ceremony is a modern innovation, you know, and that's great. And it's an innovation that happened in response to genocide, whiskey addiction, all of these kinds of things. And what you said about people being social beings, anyone who knows anything about addiction is probably familiar with the Rat Park experiment. And the bottom line of the Rat Park experiment, which is an experiment that's been reproduced a couple of times, there's a Wikipedia entry on it. The bottom line of it is this. If you put a rat in a box with two levers, one with opium and one with just water, it'll just keep taking the opium till it's off its head, and then it'll recover and do the same thing again. And then the thing about that is people say, oh, that's because opium's addictive. It's not. It's because if you put me in a box with no hope of escape and no idea what's going to go on, and you give me the two levers, I know what I would do.
Yeah. I'd be
because I'm a social creature, yeah. You know. So, and then you take the same rat, you put it into Rat Park where there's a whole bunch of other rats and there's a whole bunch of other stuff going on. You give it the same two levers and it weans itself off the drugs, basically, to cut a long story short. So the point about the rave is that the medicine, the peyote circle was a response to cultural damage and addiction that those North American First Nations people had, and the development of that structure. And the similar thing was happening in the kind of the 1980s and through into the 1990s, where in a culture that was and is significantly damaged, when this new substance came in, a ritual was created, which of course became eventually sort of criminalized in various forms. But a ritual was created, which was a collective ritual of being intensely together. So, hey, I know that you're a rat that's probably going to go back to your cubicle on Monday in order to sit in front of your spreadsheet or to deal with whatever, you know, telecom stuff that you're having, you know, whatever it is you're doing. But just for a few hours, you can be deeply and profoundly connected with all of these people and all of this music and all of this joy and all of this ecstasy. So it's a self-protective mechanism. This is actually culture doing what it's meant to do. It's like it's trying to find a way out of its disease.
Well, and it's vaguely interesting because I would consider a bunch of people going to a rave, listening to repetitive percussion music and doing ecstasy probably a lot better than a culture or a group scapegoating a group of women and murdering them. You know what I mean? So it's an interesting concept. So one thing I wanted to ask you, and we went on for a little bit, but when you were talking about these synergistic compounds that you were reading in these texts, have you ever tried doing those personally to see what the synergistic effect would be?
I've experimented with a few of them. The person who, I mean, my go-to writer for some of this stuff is a guy called Danny Nemu, who's written a couple of books, which on Psychedelic Press UK, same label as Getting Higher is. And Danny's done quite a lot of work looking at things like material from the Old Testament. And looking at the kinds of incense blends that are being, and oil blends that are being quoted as being used in things like the Ark of the Covenant and so on. So there are some quite interesting kind of things where these, you know, these substances like cassia, like frankincense, like myrrh, these things that we've, you know, we're very familiar with, the combination of them is really interesting. And certainly within the kind of my own personal work and within the sort of magical tradition, one of the things that we, you know, people spend a lot of time doing is creating incenses that are specifically for, you know, whatever the ritual is that you're doing. And yeah, you look at things like, can you, if you're introducing, you might, for example, be introducing something that's like a known psychoactive. Cannabis is an obvious example, but then the other substances that you mix with that, so whether or not you mix things like blue lotus, or whether or not you mix things like Dittany of Crete, or whether or not you mix other things with like thujone in them, those things make a difference. And yeah, it's worth exploring and experimenting with. I mean, we're fortunate now because the people who were writing those grimoires, what they mostly had to play with is they had things like the solanaceous family of plants. So they were working with henbanes and nightshade and a whole bunch of stuff, which is really strong, you know, deliriants as much as anything else. We are lucky in as much as Maria Sabina generously reminded us that the mushrooms grow on every continent with the exception of Antarctica. And of course, we also have the deliciousness of the cactus family of the phenethylamines that give us mescaline and eventually MDMA. So we have these new substances to work with that were uncommon in the Western Europe pharmacopoeia, as far as we can tell. Like I say, there are these little moments. I was looking at, you know, we were chatting before about the whole kind of Freemasonic relationship with psychedelics. And there's a book, P.D. Newman's Alchemically Stoned, which is a really interesting kind of text. And he's quite he's a pretty solid Masonic historian. It's not actually that kind of like, you know, it's not like lizard eating people from the stars. And his argument is basically that the use of things like acacia, which sort of turns up in some of the kind of Masonic stuff, might conceivably have pointed towards an understanding that this is something you can take DMT from. What is definitely the case is that the Masons bankrolled Rick Strassman when he did his research work. It's in the front of the book. I mean, it's like, don't take my word for it. Go and have a look at the front of the book. And it's like, you know, so I don't know. I mean, you know, I wasn't kind of closely involved in to be able to get into penetrate the deeper secrets of that, perhaps.
But well, and I've always had the mentality with anything is you follow the money. You know what I mean? Like if you want to see motivations and who's doing what. So his work was funded by the Freemasons, which is super interesting.
It was. Let me find you the reference so that So you want page 113. He just talks about how he got the funding, and he talks to the Scottish Rite Foundation Hospital. The name being the giveaway. September 1988, I think that is. But yeah, go and have a look at the front of the book. I mean, you know, The interesting thing about stuff like the Freemasons is that, I mean, firstly, the whole thing goes underground because of the Nazis, essentially. So there's that. And from what I could see, that this was a kind of, you know, there's a whole collection of things we could sort of say about this. But one of the interesting things historically is that Freemasonry became a space in which people with different religious traditions could meet. And by different religious traditions, I actually mean Protestants and Catholics, so they could be in the same room and not kill each other, essentially. Because you have to remember that, you know,
there was a bit of bad blood. Yeah, the Troubles were a thing.
Yeah. It's always the person like next door on the opposite side of the street who's the worst, you know. It's not like whatever. So the Freemasonry becomes one of the kind of the cultural structures from which the beginning of things like the scientific revolution, the natural philosophy kind of comes. The Royal Society for Science is modeled around a kind of Freemasonic lodge. So the first science society, which again is designed in the wake of the English Civil War to bring together all of these people and to say, for God's sake, let's just stop arguing about religion and let's instead study the book of nature. The argument being that the book of nature, so the plants and the animals and the celestial bodies and the way forces work in the universe, that's definitely the work of God. So it doesn't matter which version of the Bible you have, or indeed if you have a version, a thing called the Torah or something else, we can all agree that the world itself is the work of God. And so natural philosophy as an idea grows from this, and that's what becomes science. So, you know, Isaac Newton, who of course writes loads and loads about alchemy, is the first head of the Royal Society for Science. He's also a Freemason. So the idea of Freemasonry being this space where people can gather, men can gather, in a setting where they essentially put their religious differences aside, you know, that's quite a radical thing. And indeed it's, you know, it's arguably in some situations it's seen as dangerous for the state. That's why the Nazis put them all in jail.
Well, yeah, and the Catholic Church condemned Freemasonry in 1738, which was shortly after the formation in 1717 with Freemasonry. And now, so I'm still a little bit blown away by the fact that Freemasons sponsored Strassman's work. So acacia, I believe, is the plant that was used in sort of Kenya and Tanzania for their tribalistic use to derive DMT from, which is interesting. And so in Freemason ritualism, acacia is there quite frequently. And then even the idea of a Freemasonry, you know, sort of removing barriers of individual religious dogma and then having this idea of this creator or architect of the universe. And then, you know, even in itself has sort of a psychedelic overtone. And so, you know what I mean? Like, and another interesting thing too, and this, I'm going to take a couple leaps here, but, you know, it's thought that the Templars, you know, after their persecution by the French king and their subsequent brutal elimination, sort of rebranded themselves as the Masons. And I'm sure a lot of people dispute that, but there are some scholars who think it's a relevant thing. And then you have interesting concepts of Merovingian bloodlines and the original teachings of Christianity in Christ, which could very much be rooted in psychedelic tradition. So a continuation. And I know this is on a limb.
No. I mean, it's, you know, with a lot of this stuff, there are interesting lines to be, interesting kind of connections to be drawn. So one of the things you can, for example, say about the Templars, which is, I think, you know, pretty well supported, is the placing of them in the, to use their word, the Holy Land, exposed them to a whole variety of different things. You know, one of the things that happens when an army occupies another place is they end up being intimately affected by the culture of that other place. And so the understanding of cannabis, for example, and medical knowledge are two of the things that may have kind of percolated into the kind of Templar culture, let's call it. So we know that having gone to the Middle East, they would have experienced and encountered a whole bunch of herbs and plants and other things that were completely unknown. I mean, hemp was being grown for rope, but cannabis wasn't being produced in the kinds of forms, the intoxicating or mind altering forms that we see in places like the Middle East and Afghanistan and so on. And part of the thing about that is, again, it goes back to this kind of split that happened between the Roman Empire, between the Greek bit and the,
yeah,
and
the Constantinople the and sort of the yeah, Roman yeah. Empire.
It's Constantinople and all of that sort of stuff. So as these sort of crusades go out into this new territory, they're also reconnecting with a whole bunch of knowledge that wasn't that didn't exist before. One of the suggestions is that the Templars, whether through things like cannabis or through kind of other herbs or medical texts, that they started learning new stuff. And this new stuff kind of put them at the very least in a position of power and authority, which would allow them to be a challenge to Philip the Fair of France, who, of course, owed them a bunch of money, and the Pope at the time, who was, very much under Philip's control. So the destruction of that kind of network, I mean, again, you know, I don't know the history. It's not a specialist kind of part of what I'm interested in, but certainly from a kind of I think that there's a good case to be made for things like a continuity of practice, if not a continuity of direct personnel.
Well, yeah, so and like a continuation of psychedelic use from a very, yeah. very long time ago, permeating in secret cultures and European tradition.
And that's the thing. That's the thing. When we talk about tradition, like what we tend to think of is particularly if we're thinking of like, you know, the other, the stuff that's over there, the stuff that's distant from us. And we kind of imagine, oh, you know, the people in South America, North America, whatever, there, it's like family traditions. It's carried on forever and blah, blah, blah. It's actually much more fractured and much more complex than that. And it's certainly the case in the European tradition. So, for example, you know, I'm interested in magic. That's what I'm interested in, which, you know, is about using the imagination and changing awareness. And psychedelics are like part of that. So I don't come from a family lineage, but I am part of a lineage of practice in the same way that if I do Tai Chi, I'm part of the lineage of Tai Chi yeah. practitioners, even though I might have learned my Tai Chi from, you know, a local guy here in North Devon who, you know, bad example because he has been to China and done all that yeah. stuff. But the point is, it's the behavior, it's the practice that's the kind of that's the connecting thing. And those practices change over time, just in the same way that the Native American people of the plains, they changed their religious practices over time and they developed the peyote circle as a response to the conditions that they had, including the fact that they had to keep the drum quiet.
Yeah, the idea of environmental pressures dictating culture, dictating tradition, dictating how we move as a culture and as a species. So, you know, we were talking about the Masons and then I got a little bit off topic, but do you know, I had heard about you through Frederica Helmier, who I'd interviewed previously on the show, and she was talking about how you gave a really incredible talk about Masonry, even moving into North America, where you have like, you know, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Franklin Roosevelt, Gerald Ford, like all of these people are Masons in a continuation of this tradition. But do you see any evidence of psychedelic use in sort of the forefathers of, you know, American democracies?
Gosh, that's an interesting question. Not that I'm aware of, but like I said, so P.D. Newman and Chris Bennett are the two writers to go to for something like that. You know, Liber 420 and Alchemically Stoned, the two of the very good books. In terms of, I think that it's in a way, perhaps we're talking less about, you know, did Benjamin Franklin eat mushrooms, yeah. and more about, does this group of ideas have a resonance with the way that the American state is kind of conceptualized and constructed? And there are certainly influences there. I think one of the influences in terms of both the pragmatic fact that you have this new nation of colonists kind of constructing itself, and it has to construct itself out of lots of disparate parts. And so if you're a Freemason, you are used to the idea that, I mean, the basic idea is that, you know, here we are, we're Masons. We're going to build a cathedral, right? Imagine building a cathedral in 13th century Britain. You imagine how insanely difficult something like that is. There's no Gantt charts. There's no workflow management system. There's not even any decent communications. Like, how on earth do you do that? And more over than that, you've got probably artisans who are specialists in their field, coming from all sorts of different places, speaking different dialects, maybe even different languages. How do you gather this disparate collection of people together and start to make it make sense? That, in many respects, is how masonry kind of comes about. The fact that when we have meetings, we are familiar in our culture of having a chair and a secretary and a treasurer. Yeah, that's a Freemasonic structure. That's what it's like. You know, you have the worshipful master sits in their chair. The treasurer sits at the north of the lodge, you know, like this is how it's built. And it's built so that you can literally build a thing under quite challenging circumstances, often over multiple generations. So if you're starting to build a new nation and you're starting to build that under similar conditions where people are speaking different languages and the communications are very difficult and so on, you would tend to use a lot of the kind of similar models, and they work pretty well. They are successful for building cathedrals. And the fact that when we have meetings, we say, well, who's going to chair the meeting? Who's going to take the minutes? Okay, the secretary's going to take the minutes. That's Freemasonry. That's the structure, you know. So it's about how do you manage these complex systems? So they may not have been taking mushrooms themselves, but were they being informed by those ideas, which, like you were pointing out, Adam, they kind of have a psychedelic flavor to them. They're like, a bit like the rave, it's like, okay, how can we all do this thing together, which is quite a complicated operation, but how do we knit this together? How do we make this make sense? So one of the things that we do is we say, look, let's just call God the big G. Let's just call it the big G. In fact, let's actually have a big letter G. And we just go, right, the big G, we all agree that the big G's there. Brilliant. Okay, let's get on with whatever we're supposed to be doing, you know? And you also have quite an organized structure, because you can't have, like, Dave can't just go off and build an extra flying buttress on the cathedral and then report back next week and say, hey, Adam, I built this new buttress. I thought it would be cool. It's like, no, that's not how it works. So you have this kind of hierarchical top-down structure. You have the pyramid, you know, and that has certain benefits and it has certain limitations.
See, that's actually interesting, the notion of the organizational structure that Masonic tradition brought to the construction of arguably the entire North American construction of the state into what we perceive today. So right now, stepping back for a second to the idea that, you know, DMT, Acacia, and the Masons sort of funding research into that. So the Masons obviously still are a secretive society. I believe now they sort of let in women, and it's a little bit more different. You know, how do you view them as a modern structure now? You know, like I'm going back to them funding DMT research, because again, you follow the money. What's the relevance for them doing that? And it's curious to me.
I mean, man, it's a complicated business. I mean, I'm you know, Freemasonry for me was a lovely opportunity to be invited into that setting. I found like a bunch of really good people. I didn't see anyone eating any babies. Maybe I didn't stick around long enough. I don't know. It's not my preferred style of ritual, but I could really kind of understand, or to use a slightly dated term, grok what was going on with the process. I think that there are lots of different aspects of this. You know, there are forms of Freemasonry that are much more kind of like esoteric and magical and so on. And there are others that are much more like, this is basically a cheap bar.
Pragmatic.
And it's like, yeah, a kind of, you know, like a gents club kind of experience, you know. So I think it is, again, a broad church. I think what's interesting about that, though, is just the idea that, you know, psychedelics themselves are really, really fascinating things. They're potentially profound engines of cultural change, so much so that Nixon had to make them all illegal, because it was a really good way of destroying, you know, the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement and the anti-Vietnam movement, you know, at a stroke. You know, there's a lot of kind of different, I'm sure there are lots of different political ideas within Freemasonry, as there are within any kind of any other number of communities. But one of the things that kind of comes from it is this idea about, well, how do we do something together successfully as a community when we are all different people, when we have all this kind of like variation? How do we do this? And I think that one of the questions that kind of psychedelics invite us to explore is the same thing. You know, how do we discover our own personal truth or the our best self or whatever language we want to use in relation to that. And how do we do that kind of collectively? And how do we do that, you know, as a community as well? So I think that there are really interesting kind of relationships between psychedelics and politics, you know, and obviously Freemasonry, like any organization, probably has lots of different ranges of political opinion in them, but certainly some of them are of the view that yes, Rick, you can have your funding to go and inject people with DMT so they can see space aliens. That was obviously a thing on that occasion.
So out of curiosity then, being that you're an inhabitant of the UK, you know, you're seeing this renaissance occurring in North America. Like, are you seeing a renaissance sort of evolving with psychedelics also in the UK in the sense of people looking at the mental health concerns that are unraveling rather rampantly in front of them and realizing that perhaps psychedelics might be an equatable tool? Because, you know, both in Canada and the United States, you're seeing a relatively rapid shift in perception of policies and politicians moving towards, okay, we have a problem that requires an answer, and the answers and tools that we're currently using are really having no effect. Are you seeing a similar sort of change in mentality in the UK as well?
So Britain has remarkably repressive legislation as far as novel substances is concerned. An act was passed in 2016, which effectively outlaws anything that will be invented in the future that changes your central nervous system.
Yeah, the analogs of the concept.
Yeah, so it was originally a piece of law that was to do with dealing with synthetic cannabinoids, and essentially what it does is it kind of criminalizes the sale or indeed giving away anything that changes the central nervous system that has yet to be invented. So it's a pretty repressive piece of legislation. In practice, of course, there is, a wide ranging interest conversation. There are licensed trials going on in places like Imperial College and so on. You know, I'm involved with a thing called Breaking Convention, which is Europe's largest psychedelic conference. You know, we had it last year in April. We're going to do the next one next year. You know, we get, you know, many, many hundreds of people coming to that. I think it's 1,300 at the last one. Big event, big news story. Yeah, the conversation is definitely there. Because of the way that the FDA are, I hope, going to respond to the request for MDMA to be made a breakthrough therapy, licensed breakthrough therapy in the States, it is quite possible that Britain will follow suit soon after. We know that Australia has already gone ahead of the curve. So
right. Yeah, I know, the TGA, that's incredible.
Yeah. The lovely Ben Sessa, I know that he went over there a few months ago now to kind of like help them set up the whole thing and start kind of getting this thing working. So very soon we will have data sets that are, you know, N equals thousands rather than currently most of our research. You know, people say, oh, there's a great piece of psychedelic research, and you go, oh, how many people? And they go, oh, 16.
Yeah, yes, that's right, not really whatever. Adequate. Yeah.
But I think the interesting thing for me is that, you know, yes, these are medicines that should be potentially that, you know, good medics can deploy these things. I mean, it's people like Ben. I want to see Ben kind of like doing the work that he does because he's great and he's got his heart in the right place and whatever. I think more broadly, I'm really interested in some of the decriminalization nature work that's been done in, I'm most familiar with the stuff in the US. I was in Colorado for the conference in the DMAPS conference in Denver last year, where you can, you know, supply, move around, you know, a whole bunch of quote natural psychedelics, and culture didn't seem to have collapsed. You know, I could still go and buy a burger and, you know, go to the ATM without being accosted. You know, it was fine. So that's one of the things that America has, and the Americas have, which is very interesting, and maybe even arguably is like to do with its perhaps even one might suggest the Masonic heritage, which is that the concept of rights and the concept of like kind of not even just like sovereign individualism, but the idea that, you know, we can transform and we can change culture relatively rapidly. Britain is very, very bad at that. We do, you know, like we've been
a history of monarchy and generalized repression of ideas and thought and adherence to structured cultural norms and traditional norms. Now I kind of get that concept.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like, the plus side is more by default. So it's a bit like, you know, the paving stones on the sidewalk are down so far that when the mushroom pops up through, it does so with a degree of power, but its spore might spread elsewhere. So Britain is very, I think, seems to me to be very good at kind of creating sort of ideas and detonating them into the world, but it's not necessarily the place where they all kind of take root.
Yeah. You know? They don't hear and grow naturally or very well.
No. Whereas I think in the Americas, from what I've seen, like, you know, movements like decriminalized nature, the idea, I mean, you know, Liberty Cat Mushroom, Psilocybe semilanciata grows throughout the island. And, you know, it's incredibly safe and it's, you know, no one has a problem with it. And even under the conditions of prohibition, it's very uncommon to find people hospitalized or even just, you know, having a difficult time with this sort of stuff. And of course, it would be criminal to go and, you know, use this. Trying to get an idea like my inherent right as a citizen for cognitive liberty to do this thing in terms of British law makes absolutely no sense. Like, I can't stress how much it just doesn't compute. It's not even a thing, you know? So maybe there's something to be said for those founding father Masons constructing something which, however imperfect it might be, does seem to be better able to respond and change with circumstances. Because what the US has done is remarkable. I mean, really, you know, it is ground zero for the war on drugs. And it's also ground zero for the kind of the post-prohibition liberation in many ways. And that's quite a thing.
It is. And, you know, and existing in North American culture my entire life, it's interesting when you look at, you know, a liberal, open Western culture that is a little bit more repressive based on just its history. And then you look at North America and how quickly it can respond to change and reinvent itself very, very rapidly into both extremes that might be considered negative or positive, regardless of which. But that is an interesting notion that it stems from Masonic tradition that created it. You know, Julian, we're coming sort of to an end here, but, you know, you had talked numerous times about various things that you're writing or planning on writing. Do you have any recommendations for books or anything coming out that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to try and do some writing this year. Things that are coming up that might be interesting. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I'm doing loads of kind of online teaching. People can find all that stuff in the usual places, Instagram, blah, blah. Things I would recommend, the work of Mike Jay. So Mike Jay's book, Mescaline, Story of the First Global Psychedelic. And I'd also recommend Psychonauts, which is more recently published last year, I think it was, by Mike Jay. You know, he's an amazing guy, and those two books I really recommend. Also, as far as like picking up this stuff about the kind of lineage from the what scholars call the Western magical tradition, then Alchemically Stoned, P.D. Newman, very good. And The Giant, it's really funny, isn't it? Like, books you read books on cocaine are always like really short, start off really well and end really badly. Books on cannabis are always really thick and massive and go on forever. So this is Liber 420 by Chris Bennett. Brilliant, brilliant piece of history. So if you want to know like a few things that kind of point towards the, indigenous is a word that's very kind of whatever, but it points towards the kind of some of the European narrative about psychedelics and psychoactives. Both of those books are definitely worth picking up and having a read of. And yeah, Mike Jay's stuff, incredibly good history, very, very readable, page-turning material. Go and have a look at his work too.
Yeah, no, I'll actually leave links to all of those books in the notes when we publish this episode, because again, you know what I mean? Everything is about just educating yourself in the best way that you possibly can, because, you know, we've got decades of just sort of misinformation, the war on drugs. There's a lot to unravel.
It's true. But, you know, we are in precarious, but also delicious times, you know?
Like, I agree with that.
You know, here we are in this time where Psychedelics are not going to kind of solve all the problems, but they are probably going to be really, really valuable allies for us.
Yeah, I would say they would be a catalyst for change that we really need at this point of just repressiveness that we've been existing with for far too long. Well, anyways, Julian, I thank you for your time. I really appreciated your insights in the conversation. It was actually pretty cool.
Adam, thank you very, very much for inviting me on the podcast. Most appreciated, my friend. Thank you.
Take care.